If this was referring to Emmanuel, Jesus, what good is that to Ahaz as a sign? That's like you saying, you know, I have an exam tomorrow. I just found out. I didn't know. I just totally forgot. I just totally forgot this exam. And I come up and say, fear not. In 700 years, there's going to be a great sign for you. And everything's going to be okay. You're going to be like, that didn't help me out at all. A sign 700 years later will do nothing for Ahaz, who is dreading these two kings from attacking his land. We are in Isaiah chapter 7. We're going to be reading from verse 10. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, listen now, O house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will try the patience of my God as well? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call him Emmanuel. And he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. So there's a command to Ahaz, the wicked king, from Isaiah saying, ask for a sign. And then he says, I'm not going to ask for a sign. This was a command to ask for a sign. And he didn't ask for a sign, because if he asked for a sign and his sign came true, he would be obliged to follow along this. But his intent all the time was to hire the Assyrians to protect him from the northern kingdom of Israel and from Syria from attacking him. So it says that God himself will give a sign. Verse 13, then he said, listen now, O house of David. So now he's addressing the house of David, not just Ahaz, but the house of David. And as we talked about last time, each one of the word Y-O-U in this is plural, meaning he's speaking to a group of people, namely the house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will try the patience of my God as well? He says, you know, you push my patience a lot, Isaiah is saying, but now you're pushing God's patience here. To us, when we look at this, because we're living where we are in history, and this has already taken place, it's easy for us to wonder, well, why didn't they just get it? Why didn't they just understand? How come they're not seeing it like we see it? Well, it's because we're looking back on this event. These things were not always easy to understand. You know, Jesus spoke about this in Matthew chapter 13, verse 17. He said, for truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. And he says, you know, these people that lived in this time, it was hard for them. In 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 and 11, the Apostle Peter tells us, as to this salvation, the prophets who prophesied of the grace that would come to you made careful searches and inquiries, seeking to know what person or time the Spirit of Christ within them was indicating as he predicted the sufferings of Christ and the glories to follow. So they had to make very careful inquiry to try to figure these things out. And even his own disciples, after he had risen from the dead, he said to his own disciples on the walk to Emmaus, he said, "O foolish!" This is in Luke 24, 25. Jesus said, O foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. So you see that the prophets have spoken, but these were not that easy for them to discern. And so he's saying here, he is going to be speaking. And what we're going to see is we're going to see this rule of double reference, where you can have a prophecy, you can have prophecies in the Old Testament, and it's not that the prophecy has two fulfillments. Not at all. The prophecy has one fulfillment. But it's that there's a double reference within the prophecies that take place. In other words, you can have a sentence where the first half of the sentence speaks about one period of time, and the second half of the sentence speaks about a total separate period of time. So in other words, what we're going to see is there's a prophecies about Jesus' first coming, and then hooked right onto that are prophecies about Jesus' second coming, and you would never know that those are separate events had there not been other scriptures to peg that out for us. And you might say, well, why would the prophet describe it that way? Why would God describe it that way? Well, remember, in most cases, Isaiah was transported into the future to see things, sometimes far into the future where he's prophesying things that are going to be taking place. Not just what he sees in the future, but he's then looking back from the future. So he's transported way down here, and now he's looking back and prophesying something over here. That's the way God thinks, because when you live outside of time, we are restricted. We are parameterized by time. That is one of our dimensions. We have the three dimensions, X, Y, and Z. Then we have time as our fourth dimension. We are limited by each of these dimensions. For time, God lives outside of this, and he lives outside our three other physical dimensions. So he sees very differently than we see. So when he speaks, he will speak of something in the future, something far in the future, and something back over here. Again and again, God does that. And you say, well, why does he do that? Because when he's living outside of time, this is an indication for us to realize that our God lives outside of time. And what we're going to see prophecies strung together. And it's not just here. So, for example, in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9 and 10, we're going to see that there's a prophecy concerning the first coming of Jesus and a prophecy concerning the second coming of Jesus between verses 9 and 10 of Zechariah chapter 9, without any gap between them. So it says, rejoice, this is Zechariah 9:9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And so this is speaking about a time period in Matthew chapter 21 where Jesus comes riding into Jerusalem on a colt. And so we're familiar with that. This is speaking of Jesus' first coming. That's verse 9. Now verse 10. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow of war will be cut off. And he will speak peace to the nations, and his dominion will be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So this is speaking of Jesus' second coming. From one verse to another, you get transported like this. You see the same sort of thing in Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11, reading from verse 1. Then a shoot will spring forth from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make decisions by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. All right, so that's one period. Now he takes a jump. He says, and he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. And now he jumps to another period, and the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. So you see, he's jumping between periods of time. The first part, he was speaking about Jesus' first coming, so we look back on that. Then he's speaking about Jesus' future coming. And so you see, I don't want you to be confused as we go through Isaiah chapter 7. You're going to see a jump here, but I'm warning you up front, there is this jump, And this is called the rule of double reference, not double prophecy. Prophecy has one fulfillment, but it's a rule of double reference. So he says here, he says that, verse 14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. So you see back up in verse 11, he said, you go ahead and ask for a sign. It can be deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. So between heaven and hell, you can choose anything you want. Choose any sign you want, I will give it to you. Ahaz refuses to do it, so God himself says, I'll give you a sign. So this is going to be some big sign. God chooses a sign. He says, behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Actually, the word is Alma, this word virgin. We understand in English what virgin means. There is no mistake. In English, it is very clear. Virgin has a meaning, and we are clear on that meaning. This word virgin, the words that is used here is Alma. In modern Hebrew, the word virgin, to be equivalent with our word virgin, would not be Alma, it would be Betula. That is the word that is used today in modern Hebrew, but it was never that in classical Hebrew. And so in classical Hebrew, Betula, some people say if he was really speaking of a real virgin, he would have used the term Betula. No, classical Hebrew used the word Alma. But what else is here is it says it's not just Alma. It has here the definite article. It has ha, Alma. Not a virgin, but the virgin. Ha, Alma. This the virgin. And so the rules of study for the Jews is clear. When it says the virgin, you have to look in the immediate context. What's the virgin that he's talking about? Who is this virgin he's talking about? But there is no virgin, there is no woman talked about in this chapter, nor in the chapter before. There's nowhere in this context that he's speaking of a woman. So why is he saying the virgin? It's translated in our Bibles as a virgin, but look in the Young's literal translation. It will say the virgin. It is very clear. It is ha-alma, and the virgin. So the rules of Jewish study are always, if there is nothing in the immediate context to tell you who he's speaking about, it is who would a typical Jew think about for using that definite article, the word the virgin, not a virgin, but the virgin. And what that harkens back to is Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, it was put before us a mystery, and it is this. And I will put enmity, God is speaking to the devil, and he says to the snake, he says, and I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise you on your head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. This is a very strange verse. It speaks of the seed of a woman. Always in Scripture, generally it's speaking about the seed of a man. But here, what is the seed of a woman? There was no earthly father. So this is the seed of Mary. This is the seed that Mary was going to bear. And this seed was the Messiah. This was a prophecy in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. A promise that the seed is going to be of woman. And that seed would conquer the enemy. This is now explained to us in Isaiah chapter 7. Isaiah is revealing to us what Genesis was talking about. I mean, this guy just nails it over and over again. And he's talking about the virgin. The virgin is making reference to Genesis 3:15. And he says the word virgin. Virgin classically always meant the equivalent, Alma always meant classically the equivalent of our word virgin, which, by the way, God has always prized virginity. And so he says, Alma. And what happens is, so we have three big classical rabbis that Jews will read their interpretation of things. There's Rashi, there's Radak, and there's Ibn Ezra. And so these three classical rabbis that all are medieval rabbis, they lived between about 1,000 and 1,200 AD. By 1,000 and 1,200 AD, you can see the rabbis were trying to cover up anything that was Christian. So they say this is speaking of Hezekiah, which just doesn't fit at all. And they will argue that Alma doesn't necessarily mean virgin. It necessarily means virgin. They will argue that Betula is the word that he wanted to use, would have used if he meant virgin. But that's actually not the case. Christian theologians have dissected this. I mean, you can find whole books on their dissection of this. It is so vast what the Christian theologians have done, and it just swamps anything that the rabbis have written on this. And so, for example, if it were Betula, it just doesn't fit. So, for example, in Genesis 24, verse 16, Betula, without a qualifier in the scriptures themselves, does not necessarily mean virgin. So in Genesis 24, verse 16, it says, the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, a Betula. The girl was very beautiful, the Betula. And no man had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. You see, when it uses the word Betula, it had to have the qualifier, and no man had relations with her. If Betula could stand on its own as virgin, why would it need the qualifier? It needed the qualifier because it could not stand on its own. That word Betula could not stand on its own. You see the same sort of thing in Judges chapter 21, verse 12. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins, 400 young Betulas, who had not known a man by lying with him. You see, immediately it gives the qualifier, because Betula by itself would not speak of virgin. Only Alma can speak of virgin. And you see the same thing in the prophet Joel. Prophet Joel, verses chapter 1, verse 8. Wail like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. Wail like a Betula girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. In other words, this was a widow, and it's speaking of a widow calling her a Betula. That's not virgin in our context. A widow is not spoken of as a virgin in English. And that's why this is clearly the word that would be used. All right, so there's that. There's the other point on this. In the Septuagint, which was written in 250 BC, the Septuagint LXX, where the scholars took the Hebrew Bible and translated it into Greek. In 250 BC, so 250 years before the coming of Jesus, before rabbis were trying to cover up about a virgin birth, this is what the scholars wrote. They in the Septuagint from the Isaiah scrolls, the way they translated it is Parthenos. Parthenos means virgin in Greek. Parthenos, clearly virgin. So you see the scholars, the rabbinic scholars prior to the coming of Jesus were using the word, this word Parthenos for virgin. This is clearly virgin. And we know this is a virgin from Luke chapter 1, verse 26. It says, now in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to the city in Galilee called Nazareth to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph, of the descendants of David, and the virgin's name was Mary. It just nails it. This is a virgin. It tells us in the New Testament. This was a miracle. It was an absolute miracle. If it is not here in the prophet Isaiah, then that there is no other prophecy within the entire scriptures that tells us what Gabriel says in the gospel according to Luke. That's where the prophecy came of the virgin birth. And clearly, the rabbis prior to the coming of Jesus, they weren't trying to cover up anything, and they clearly translated this as virgin. There's the area of cognate studies. There's other Semitic languages. So there's Arabic, Ugaritic, Phoenician, Babylonian, Ebalaite, Aramaic, and all of them use this alm, which is the root of alma, meaning a virgin. All of them say Alm is virgin. So Hebrew would have to be the only one of the Semitic languages that doesn't use Alm as meaning absolutely virgin. You see how there is a cover-up by the rabbis. And I will say it, there's a cover-up by the rabbis. And you see this even in our own scriptures, in the New Testament. They tried to cover up the resurrection of Jesus. They encouraged the soldiers to lie and to say, the body was stolen when we were asleep. These disciples stole the body when we were sleeping, which is a total lie. Because if the soldiers were sleeping, how do you know who stole the body? You know, even the lie doesn't make sense. They were trying to cover this thing up. And you see the cover-up in the medieval rabbis. These great medieval rabbis are covering this thing up. But prior to their coming, so 1,200 years before these medieval rabbis, the rabbis were properly translating this. And finally, you know, they'll say, well, this means maiden, just an unmarried woman. Look, an unmarried woman having a baby is not much of a sign. I guarantee you in this city there were more than a dozen unmarried women this weekend had babies. There's nothing miraculous about that. Unmarried women have babies all the time. Happens in this city every night, every day. Dozens of them. That's not a miracle. God said, I'm going to give you a miracle. I'm going to give you a sign. It's going to be as high as heaven or as low as Sheol. I'm going to give you. It's a sign when it's a virgin. You see, this is clearly a virgin birth. And this is where it's prophesied, okay? And so don't let anybody, you know, convince you differently, all right? They're wrong, right? And you can trust me or read about these. Christian scholars have just they ate the rabbi's lunch on this one. Chapter 7, verse 15. Now it says, verse 15, he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. So when he comes to be able to choose evil, to refuse evil and choose good. When a boy comes to a time of being able to refuse evil and choose good, so in other words, there's some moral standing in this boy. Well, how do you really know? You know, it's kind of nebulous. Does he? Well, he says it's going to. He says that he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. So if he's eating curds and honey. Some Bibles translate it butter and honey. It's just coagulated milk fat is what it is. I mean, it's you can do it by adding an acid like lemon, or you can do it by heating it up, or you can do it by trituration. Trituration means pounding on it, so eating curds and honey. When this boy is eating curds and honey, then you know that he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. And even a three-year-old knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. They know when they're doing wrong if you've taught them, so you'll be able to see it by when he does this. And he says in verse 16, "For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken." So remember, within 1 year after this prophecy, within 1 year. Syria falls to the Assyrians. Within 2 years after that, the northern kingdom, Jerusalem, Israel, Samaria, Ephraim, falls to the Assyrian king. So within 3 years, both of those kings would fall. Now, I ask you, you see how this is two different people. This is two different people. This boy in verse, this son in verse 14, this is Emmanuel. This is Jesus, the virgin birth. Verse 15 now, he's talking about a different boy. He says in verse 16, he says, before the boy knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. Who is the boy? There's the definite article, the boy. You have to look in the immediate context. The immediate context is right there in verse 3 of chapter 7. Bring your son, Shir Jashub. He's coming with this boy in his arms. I don't know, maybe he's a month old, maybe he's 2 months old. He's not yet weaned. He's not yet eating. He's only nursing from his mother. He's carrying this boy. He's before this boy is going to be eating curds and honey. And that's when he's going to be able to discern evil and good. You know, within 3 years, the two kings who you are dreading will be forsaken. If this was referring to Emmanuel, Jesus, what good is that to Ahaz as a sign? That's like you saying, you know, I have an exam tomorrow. I just found out. I didn't know. I just totally forgot. I just totally forgot this exam. And I come up and say, fear not. In 700 years, there's going to be a great sign for you. And everything's going to be okay. You're going to be like, that didn't help me out at all. A sign 700 years later will do nothing for Ahaz, who is dreading these two kings from attacking his land. It does nothing for him. So he gives to the house of David a sign that's going to come in the future. But to Ahaz, the sign concerning these two kings, this is a sign. You see this little kid here? Before he's weaned, you're going to be delivered. Before he's weaned, you're going to be delivered. This is the sign. This is what I'm talking about. This is the double reference. You have one prophecy, and then back to back with that is another prophecy of two different time periods. One is within the next 3 years, and which is really the test of a prophet anyway. If I say I'm a prophet, and I prophesy something that's going to take place in 1,000 years, none of you can prove me wrong. It's just not going to happen. The sign of a prophet anyway is that there's near-term prophecies that are being answered. And this is the sign of Isaiah's prophecy, because people are going to see this and they're going to know. This was a sign to Ahaz, but this sign for Ahaz is not going to do Ahaz himself any good, because Ahaz is going to be in big trouble too, because he didn't believe it. He didn't embrace it. But you see, this is two separate prophecies, two separate time periods, separated by 700 years. That's what it is. One is concerning the Messiah is going to be born. This is the sign to the house of David. And the other is concerning, and the first one is underscoring Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman, something that the Jews couldn't understand until it was revealed here. And then in verse 15, he talks about this boy in my arms. He's going to, by the time he's weaned, before he's weaned, these two kings that you're worrying about are going to be no more. There'll be no more. This is the sign to Ahaz, because remember, it says back up in verse 11, ask a sign for yourself. Ahaz, ask a sign for yourself. So he gave Ahaz, that's the sign to Ahaz. And you see, the scriptures just nail it over and over and over again. It is so clear what he does, how this thing is just over and over again. It just says this. This is what he wants us to do. This is what he wants us to take hold of. I mean, if we just take hold of what his word says over and over again, I mean, we're gonna be protected. The scriptures say in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 20, verse 20, it says, "You can rely on his prophets. You can rely on his prophets." It says they rose early in the morning and they went out into the wilderness of Tekoa. And when they went out, Jehoshaphat stood and said, "Listen to me, O Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Put your trust in the Lord your God, and you will be established. Put your trust in his prophets and succeed." You can trust this book. You can bank on this book. You trust God. You trust his prophets. What is written here is trustworthy over and over again. This is what he wants us to take hold of. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for your word, that over and over again, your word is true. It has been tried, and it is true. We have seen these prophecies fulfilled concerning Syria, concerning Aram and the northern kingdom. We've seen the prophecies fulfilled concerning the virgin birth, concerning the coming of Jesus. And Lord, these other prophecies that go beyond that, they too will be fulfilled concerning his second coming, concerning the kingdom beyond that. Lord, I pray your grace upon these young people, that they would learn to put their trust in you and be established, and to trust your word, the prophets, and to trust your word, Father, that they could bank on this. Lord, your grace abound upon them, I pray. The grace of Jesus, I pray. For the glory of Jesus and in his name, amen. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to give to help out with these podcasts, you can go to jesusandscience.org. All donations are tax deductible. We have no employees in this organization. All the money just goes for the contract work on the production. Thanks so much.